KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Skagit River Bridge. The 38-year-old was a 16-year veteran with the State Patrol. This is KUOW News. I'm Jamala Henderson.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. What do you know about the universe? Maybe that word is inaccurate in and of itself. Theoretical physicist Brian Green says we should think of ourselves as part of a multiverse. He's going to be here later this hour to tell us why. Also, acclaimed actress Pamela Reed makes her professional Seattle stage debut tonight. We're going to talk with her about that. The city of Seattle issued the newest version of its bicycle master plan last night. Tom Fucoloro is an independent journalist who writes the Seattle Bike Blog. He joins us now. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. Is this a new plan, an update, a revision? What exactly is this?
So this is the second draft of an update, a big update that they're doing to the 2007 plan. And it really represents a ton of feedback from the community around how can we make the city safe for bicycling for everybody, no matter what your age and ability is, or how do we make it so that the city is accessible to people who might feel like it's a little bit dangerous today. So this update is about how can we connect the neighborhoods and homes in all neighborhoods to the commercial centers and employment centers, and do that safely and equitably.
So what are they thinking are the biggest barriers to people who maybe want to bicycle, but they're not, as they actually included in a chart, the sort of 1% kamikazes who are going to go out there and ride no matter what?
Right. Yeah, so the plan is focused on kind of two tools that have kind of proven across the globe to be effective at encouraging just, you know, everyday people, not super bold or extreme seekers, to get out on a bicycle. And that's when a bike lane is on a busier street, there'll be kind of separation from the traffic lanes. So maybe protected by a layer of parked cars or a curb of some kind.
Oh, so an actual physical barrier.
Yeah. Yeah, so it will feel much more comfortable. You know, someone who feels comfortable biking on the Burke-Gilman Trail should be able to feel comfortable biking on these, what they're called, cycle tracks. But yeah, protected bike lanes.
So does that mean they're doing away with those sharrows, which are lanes that were the cars and bikes were theoretically going to share?
Yeah, well, they are. The sharrows have proven a little bit confusing, and the plan definitely de-emphasizes painting many more of them, especially on busy streets. But you will see a lot of them pop up on neighborhood streets. So the other tool that the plan really focuses on is what they're calling neighborhood greenways. And that's basically a residential street that they prioritize for biking and walking. So it'll be signed, it'll have little bikes painted in the center, and it'll have these kind of safety features so that when you get to a busy street, you'll know that there'll be some safe way to cross that street. Because as people know now, you know, sometimes your neighborhood street dead ends into a busy street and there's no way to get across. So these are kind of geared towards providing a network of streets like that where you can expect to be safe from beginning to end. And more importantly, you know, they're designed so that anyone from age 8 to age 80 should be able to travel them safely.
I know that they have experimented, at least in the Wallingford neighborhood, with actually shutting some neighborhood streets to car traffic. They're not going so far as that across the city.
I'm not aware of which street you're talking about in Wallingford there. But no, these would not be shut down to traffic. They would be cars. People will still be able to access their homes and their driveways on the streets, but they're definitely going to be designed so that, you know, if someone is biking in the street, that it's clear that they kind of have the priority and that they should get some space and some extra little patience. Sometimes they will have ways to encourage cars to use other streets instead of that one. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's a side street where people are kind of cutting through to avoid traffic on the main street, they'll try to discourage that, but they're not going to stop people from driving on these streets.
How much is this bike plan estimated to cost?
You know, I don't know if they have a dollar amount yet. It's a 20-year plan, and I'm sure the price tag's pretty high, but, you know, it's something that I think they'll deal with project by project. But yeah, no, I don't have the dollar amount. Sorry.
Well, I didn't see one in the plan myself either, but I thought you write the bike blog, so I'm assigning to you to find out how much it's going to cost us. Aside from feeling safe, what do experts and planners see to be the biggest barrier to getting more people onto bicycles?
Aside from safety, you know, just having a clear, inviting place where you know that this route will kind of connect you to where you need to go. You know, I think sometimes it's a little bit confusing. You know, people don't know, you know, which streets should I take to get to work or into the grocery store. And so a lot of this plan involves making it more intuitive to use in the first place.
Mm-hmm. So there'll be maps and things that are more publicly marked for people?
Yeah, exactly. And signage along the on the streets. I think another barrier is just that, you know, safe bike routes tend to be in neighborhoods that are already a little bit wealthier. So mm-hmm. the plan has a very explicit focus that, you know, every home in Seattle, every neighborhood in Seattle deserves to have a way for people to get around safely on foot and by bike. And so they tried to put these cycle tracks, neighborhood greenways, you know, inviting features close to everybody's home, not just, you know, certain neighborhoods who kind of have the ability to lobby for mm-hmm. themselves. So that's a really exciting part of the plan.
You mentioned that this is a 20-year plan. What happens most immediately?
I don't know. I think it's the kind of thing where, you know, the next step is what will the city do to fund it?
Mm-hmm.
'Cause it's, you know, on its own, it's just a piece of paper. In order to actually start making some progress on it, they're going to have to put some money behind it. So that's kind of the next step. So that will kind of guide, you know, the scope that the city will be able to bite off, you know, right off the bat.
So it goes to the city council, in other words.
Yeah, yeah. It's not been approved or anything. This is just a second draft. It'll probably still be modified a little bit here and there. But it's a really the first draft had kind of planned bike lanes all over the place, and then they went and talked to a lot of neighborhoods, and they talked to freight interests, and they talked to transit interests, and looked at the transit master plan, and kind of whittled it down until now they have something that meets their equity goals,
mm-hmm.
But also, you know, takes into compromises in a lot of places.
Well, I'm looking forward to those segregated bike lanes. That sounds like a great idea to me. So I guess we'll just wait, and you'll be following it at your blog, I'm assuming.
Yes, definitely.
Okay, well, thank you for taking time to talk to us this morning.
Yeah, thank you.
Tom Fucaloro is an independent journalist, and he writes the Seattle Bike Blog, which you can find at seattlebikeblog.org.
It's 9:15. Actor Pamela Reed from the TV show Parks and Recreation is performing in a play at ACT Theater here in Seattle. Marcy talks with Pamela Reed in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the Old West town of Winthrop, Washington, with year-round scenery and outdoor recreational opportunities, including hiking, biking, camping, and river rafting, close to Seattle via the scenic North Cascades Highway. Lodging and recreational information at winthropwashington.com.
64 degrees in Seattle, expecting to hit 77 this afternoon with sun all day. You count on KUOW to provide you with intelligent reporting that nurtures your knowledge. KUOW takes you beyond the headlines, gives you a deeper perspective on important issues. Right now is a great time to renew your annual KUOW membership or make a special gift. You may have received a special appeal in the mail. Please mail back your gift or make it online at kuow.org by June 30th. And thanks. It's 9:16. I'm Bernard Ouellette. This universe we live in may be just one of many universes, part of a multiverse. Theoretical physicist Brian Greene will help us try to wrap our minds around that idea in 25 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. What happens when a nice conservative family living near Palm Springs finds out that their rather disaffected daughter's written a tell-all memoir? That's a question behind John Robin Bates' play, Other Desert Cities. The play opens this week at ACT Theater, and veteran actress Pamela Reed is one of the stars of the show, and she joins me in the studio today. It's great to meet you.
It is so lovely to meet you.
I know you're a big public radio fan, so we can talk about that later. But I want to talk about this character, Polly Wyeth, who you play.
Yes, yes. She's the mother, you know, and she's a pretty just to the right of Attila the Hun. And she's she was mentored by Nancy and Reagan and Betsy Bloomingdale and Mrs. Annenberg, and those gals are a little bit older than she was, you know, back in the day. And the play takes place at Christmas, and the daughter comes home with a memoir. And the eldest son has committed suicide, and it is not something that is wished to be revisited. But not everything that is seen is seen in this play until the play progresses. So that is the premise of what things are, but not necessarily what they are.
What attracted you to the play and the character?
Well, I have to say the first thing that attracted me was that it was going to be done in Seattle at ACT, and I wanted to come home and do a play. I graduated from University of Washington, went straight to New York in 1975, and I haven't done a play at home since then.
Wow.
So it was always been
really?
A dream to do a play at home. And I had met with Kurt several months ago. And
that'd be Kurt Beatty.
Kurt Beatty, yes, of course. I'm sorry. And the artistic director of ACT. And he showed me all around it, and it's just so beautiful. The whole operation is just lovely, and it's just wonderful that this vibrant, important theater is still up and running and putting out great, great productions. And so when this opportunity came up and to work with Victor Pappas, who I've wanted to work with, who I knew from New York, and so it just came and here I am.
You know, you like many people who trained at the University of Washington, theater was what people were wanting to do. When I talk to young drama students, it's always sort of theater, but you've done a lot of it. You've won awards for it, but you know, in our society, you're in a hit TV show, Parks and Recreation. You've been in other television shows, and it seems like a double-edged sword because that's sort of how you really make a living. Very few people sort of make it in New York on stage.
You know, When I was such a snob when I came to New York, I didn't even want to do Broadway because it was too commercial, you know, let alone do a commercial, which I did a couple of commercials eventually, and I could tell the stories. There's some of my best acting stories are from the commercials I did. They were so funny. But, you know, you wind up having a life in art. And American actors have this conundrum. You know, we live our epicenter of our theater world is 3,000 miles from the epicenter of the film world. And even though I didn't have ambition to do film and television, and it was strictly this purist monochromatic vision of what I thought an American actor should be, I ended up doing all of it over the last 37 years. And it's been fantastic. I wouldn't want it any other way. But a lot of actors have to make this choice here. Whereas if you go to Berlin or London or Paris, Munich, they're all working in all mediums. Acting is acting, you know. And granted, the venue provides a different kind of focus. But nevertheless, it's still acting. And good writing is good writing.
We're talking with Pamela Reed, and John Robin Bates is one of the acknowledged good writers.
Oh,
I assume
yes.
That was one of the enticements for this play, besides the fact that it was in your native land here up in the Northwest. How did you get from New York to L.A.? Was it a film offer?
Now, I was, my first film, the films, you know, auditioned for in New York, but they shoot all over, and then people in L.A. take note, and then they, you know, want. But I never, ever intended to live in Los Angeles. I went to New York, and it was like welcome home. I was totally comfortable. I fit right in. It was not a problem. But I fell in love with my husband of 25 years, in 1986, Sandy Smolin, and I, he was a director, and we met on a film. He was directing a film, as the joke always goes, you know, he hired me, so I married him. And so he was in L.A. a lot, and I kept thinking, what would Joanne Woodward do? So we thought we'd be there for a year, and it ended up, I think it was, yeah, we bought our second home, two kids, dogs, a couple of cars, had moved out of our first home, and decided maybe we should sublease the apartment in New York or even get rid of it for a while, you know. So it was a slow transition.
Did you feel like an Angeleno? Did you have that same embracing feeling when you moved from New York to L.A.?
No, I was not an Angelina. I became a different snob, of course.
No, I hated it.
Now, I love Los Angeles. It's a great American city. It's thriving. It has food, finally. I used to go there when I first came. When I was shooting Melvin and Howard, I was crying. I thought, I'm going to starve here. There was nowhere to eat. Nowhere. And now, you know, it's great. You know, it's an Epicurean's delight in many areas of Los Angeles. Wonderful.
And now is the time where we say that, of course, you've left that behind and moved to the great metropolis of Tacoma, where you grew up.
Well, hey, you know, I love Tacoma. I live in University Place, right on the Puget Sound.
It's gorgeous.
I have a 180 view of the Puget Sound. And, you know, you find me something better to look at in the Olympics and then Fox Island and the Narrows Bridge, and it's gorgeous. And I just bop up here and do the play. I love it.
And so your husband is, I assume, still his work is in L.A. or
we go back and forth. He's shooting right now in San Francisco today, and we just, it's fine. It's not that hard.
No,
it's really not. We try not to do anything at the same time because our daughter's still, she's a senior. So, you know, we want to have somebody around. But our son's on his own in L.A. doing his thing and working. And we're able to go back and forth right now. I don't know how long this is going to last, but this is what we're doing now.
And so it's not, in terms of working, it's not out of sight, out of mind. Well, Pam's up. She's in the Northwest. We don't see her. We're not going to cast her.
Well, I haven't been, I don't audition, anything that requires an audition, I've gone down once. I'm pretty much doing things that are offered right now because I want to be here. Poor me. I'm from the Pacific Northwest, you know, let's all get out the hankies. I love it here. I'm so happy to be home.
So now you're working at ACT. This is your Seattle stage debut? Is that true?
Yeah, I didn't realize that. I mean, I've acted when I was at UW, but, oh, sorry, I didn't turn my phone down.
Oh, that's okay.
It's my Seattle
stage
professional stage debut. It is. You're right.
Wow. So 30 years after you set out on this, 30-some years after you set out on this path for yourself, now you're back.
Yeah. And, you know, I was the first production in Meany Hall.
You were?
Yeah. And now they don't do, but yeah, we did John Wooden's SSM production, translation of Good Person of Sichuan, the Brecht.
So do you have the opportunity to do classics, those things that drama students
trained for the classical theater?
Yeah.
I worked a lot with Joe Papp. I worked a lot with Joe. I did All's Well That Ends Well in Central Park. I did Helena, which was nice. It's the largest role in the canon for a woman. But I haven't done most of my stuff is modern. I've premiered a couple of Sam Shepard plays, Marcia Norman. I've done a lot of. I love modern theater, though. I love the whole process of finding the final draft and the rehearsal process and all of that.
Well, this play, this is not a world premiere, but this is a contemporary play back to the other desert cities. How should audiences approach seeing you in your Seattle stage debut? Do we need to...
Hopefully kindly. Hopefully with forgiveness in their hearts. No, it is the premiere of the play here. It just premiered in Los Angeles. It was at Lincoln Center, so now the play's out. Mm-hmm. And so the smart theaters are grabbing it. It's a mountain of a play. It's absolutely one of the most challenging roles I've ever had. And everyone in the cast says it. It's really, really multifaceted. It's the kind of play that you could go back a second time and get a lot of things you wouldn't get your first time. He's a marvelously bright and facile writer and challenging, not in terms of not being able to understand, but to bring it all to the table, to bring the full meal to the table, because there's a lot there to chew on.
When was the last time that you worked in a nonprofit regional theater company like ACT Theater?
I've been doing a lot of theater at ACT, actually, except they call it ACT in San Francisco.
Right.
I love that theater.
So
I love the Geary.
So you're used to that. I mean, it's a different rhythm, you know, the 4 weeks of rehearsal and then the 4 weeks on stage and, you know, on to the next.
And then you're on to the next. I know. I was kind of whining about it this morning to my husband. I was saying, you know, God, we're about to finish previews, and then there's only three more weeks. It's just barely getting started, you know. But you know, you want to, in terms of the vibrancy of the city, you know, and they want to taste what's out there. It's fine. God bless those people who come.
When you left here for New York, we had theater, but 30-some years ago, this city wasn't the same theatrically. There are a number of professional companies now. And
there were more even than there are now. And then when the economy tanked, a lot of, look at Empty Space. It was a great theater. And several others that couldn't withstand the economic downturn. And hopefully with things changing a bit, you know, we'll see an influx because the arts are hit pretty quickly, as you know, that we'll be able to see more theater. Because you know, you can make your living as an actor in New York and L.A., but you could also make your living in Chicago, and you still can, and Seattle. And that's known, you know, but it's been a little more difficult in Seattle because of the economy.
Well, Pamela, it's delightful to have had you in here, and we'll look forward to seeing you in Other Desert Cities by John Robin Bates. The play opens tonight at ACT Theater, and good luck returning home and reestablishing your roots.
It is my great privilege. Thank you.
This is Weekday on KUOW.
It's 9:29. At least in this part of this universe, it is. Our next guest says we need to expand our minds to consider the possibility that this might be just one of many universes. And he's a theoretical physicist, so maybe he's onto something. Brian Green joins us in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Earth Justice, a nonprofit law firm that believes a healthy environment is a fundamental right, working to protect the waters of Puget Sound and the native salmon and orca that live there. More information at earthjustice.org. Earth Justice, because the earth needs a good lawyer.
Sunny day in Seattle. It's 64 degrees, and we're expecting to reach 77 this afternoon. We're going to have some clouds overnight with a low of 56, and then clouds tomorrow morning. But tomorrow should wind up partly sunny in the afternoon with a high of 70.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Symphony, presenting Benjamin Britten's War Requiem on June 13th and 15th, conducted by Ludovic Morlot and featuring two orchestras, three vocal soloists, and three choirs. Tickets and information by calling the box office or online at seattlesymphony.org.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:30. Tropical storm Andrea is gaining strength, and it's getting closer to Florida. An update in the news at 11.
That's music by Philip Glass, part of Icarus at the Edge of Time. From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. You might think about science as an incomprehensible high school class that you endured to get to your graduation. But if you're a scientist, you know that the field is thrilling. And if you're not convinced, you need to check out one of physicist Brian Greene's TED Talks. Brian Greene has been called the superstar of super string theory. He co-directs Columbia University's Institute for Strings Cosmology and Astroparticle Physics, which almost sounds like a musical title in and of itself. Brian Greene has written books, including the newest, The Hidden Reality, which explores the very real possibility that our universe is one of many, a multiverse. Brian Greene, it's great to have you back in Seattle. And we heard just a clip of Philip Glass, so you've moved beyond theory. It really is, Institute for Strings really is about music now.
Well, the work that we do with Philip wasn't directly related to my academic job, but I do step out of the academic world now and then to try to bring science to general audiences, sometimes in novel ways. And the piece with Philip is an example of that. It began as a book that I wrote for kids. It was a rewriting of the myth of Icarus, where this mm-hmm. time the boy doesn't go to the sun, but he goes to a black hole against his father's warning, as in the original story. In this version, he doesn't die, but the real physics of Einstein's general relativity kicks in and determines how the story ends. So Philip got interested in the story, so we turned it into a live stage presentation where he wrote an original orchestral score. Two artists from the UK made a beautiful film, and then it's narrated sort of Peter and the Wolf style. So it's a journey to the edge of time.
Are you the narrator?
I sometimes am. Tonight I'm not. It's Cal Penn from House fame, as I understand it, although I rarely watch television, so I don't really know what that all means.
Harold and Kumar's Excellent Adventures kind of guy.
Gotcha.
He's part of the Obama administration at
yeah,
that point.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be a fun ride where basically the audience doesn't need to know any science, and they're not lectured to, per se, but they get a feel for what happens at the edge of a black hole by virtue of the story.
I was curious, listening to the TED Talks or watching your TED Talks and reading about you, if you were one of those kids who used to, you know, lay on your back in the summer, look up at the night sky and wonder where it ended or where it went.
Well, the only problem with that is I grew up in Manhattan, so when you looked at the night sky, maybe you saw one little dot.
Oh,
you know?
No.
So it was unclear that there was a night sky when I was growing up. But the big question certainly did captivate me when I was young, but it was more from the mathematical, theoretical side of things that I began. My dad, who didn't go to college, didn't finish high school, was very interested in ideas and taught me a lot of stuff when I was little. And he taught me how to multiply numbers. So from an early age, I was playing with numbers all the time. And when I subsequently learned that math can tell you things about the world, that was captivating.
I think for me, and clearly in the introduction, I didn't say that I didn't study physics, but I never did take a physics class. And for me, the connection between math and physics is a little obscure. So how do they tie in? How do you figure out the matter through numbers?
Well, it's a beautiful story in the history of ideas that we have learned that there's a mathematical order to the way the world is put together, and that order manifests itself everywhere. The matter in this room is described by equations that speak to how the matter moves and how it behaves, allowing us to make numerical predictions for how electrons and quarks and protons and neutrons and atoms and molecules all interact and behave. And the amazing thing is the mathematics doesn't just give a vague description of reality. It gives a precise description. We can do calculations that may take us hundreds of pages long to complete that then tell us about the properties of these little particles like electrons. We go out into the world and we measure those particles with fantastic equipment, and the equations and the observations agree to 10 decimal places for some of these calculations. Can you imagine how thrilling it is to do a calculation with 10 decimal places and then it agrees with what you see in the world? It's really thrilling.
So the math, the calculations are the proof of what you have observed.
And they are the underlying description of what you've observed. So what you see is very surfacey, right? I mean, you just have access to just so much with your eyes or even with equipment. But the math goes deeper and gives you the mathematical underpinning, the mathematical architecture of reality. Now, why is it that math does such a good job? I don't know. Nobody really does. Our best guess is that math is the language of pattern.
Hmm.
And the world has intrinsic patterns that repeat. You know, the sun and the earth have an interesting choreography that they replicate day by day by day. Same thing goes for the motion of galaxies. Same thing goes for the motion of particles. And it's that replication, that pattern, that orderliness that math is able to capture.
You know, I was thinking back to Icarus and from, you know, the beginning of recorded stories of human beings, there's always been a curiosity whether, you know, the stories about, you know, the stars and three wise men following what we believe might be a comet to early observations of waxing and waning periods of movement of the solar system. You know, we've had that curiosity. At what point did somebody, was it Da Vinci? When did they start actually bringing that down to those numbers that they, you know, count on their hands and toes?
Well, there's evidence that goes way back to the ancient Greeks that they were beginning to find the mathematical patterns inherent in things that were happening in the world around us. And you can see the motivation for it when you are thrust on this planet and you see all sorts of phenomena taking place. It's a scary place.
Mm-hmm.
The moon goes away sometimes, tremendous thunderstorms. You're looking for some underlying order. Now, some people find the order in positing gods, deities that
right.
are behind it all. But the problem with that is, however satisfying or, you know, anxiety-reducing that perspective might be, it's not predictive. It doesn't allow you to know what's going to happen tomorrow. But when the Greeks and then the Egyptians and others began to find the mathematical order, they could start to predict when things will happen. That's an amazingly powerful story. Then Newton is the person who really takes this forward in the late 1600s, where he codifies everything in a few laws, Newton's laws that mm-hmm. we all learn in high school, which are these powerful, simple mathematical expressions that describe so much about the world. And that really is where modern physics gets launched.
When you travel to Europe, there are science museums that you can go to. I've been there when my son was young. We went to visit them, where you see things like Foucault's pendulum. And in Paris, it's kind of hanging in the middle of this museum. There's a Da Vinci museum. There's museums throughout Italy that are based on sort of one person's questions and the attempts to create devices that will do the measuring, because at some point, you know, when you realize, oh, it's 28 days between when the moon looks like a sickle and the moon looks like a ball, that, you know, you then have periods of 28. But at some point, you need to develop means to calculate to, as you said, you know, 85 decimals out. So, you know, if you look at that canon, is it Newton? Who do you look to and say, you know, here's where modern physics really started?
I would say it's really Newton. You could say Galileo, so somewhere in that period. But Newton's laws, amazingly, are laws that are still relevant now, you know, 2.5, 3 centuries later. And even when you go to graduate school, the equations that you learn are direct analogs in many ways of Newton's perspective. So we've certainly gone way beyond the perspective that Newton gave us. We've developed quantum physics as sort of the big break, and Einstein's relativity, the other big break. But all of these basically extend Newton's reasoning. They don't wipe out Newton's perspective, which is a view that oftentimes the general public doesn't understand fully enough. Progress in science is much more nuanced. It's not revolution after revolution that wipes out the past. No, Newton still does the great job of predicting how a baseball will fly.
Right.
But if that baseball is near a black hole, then you do need Einstein's ideas, because Newton's range of applicability is relatively small compared to what's out there. If the baseball is going near the speed of light, you need Einstein's special relativity to figure out what's going on. If you make that baseball the size of an electron, you do need quantum physics to come in. But Newton did a great job.
We're talking with theoretical physicist Brian Greene and his collaboration with Philip Glass. Icarus at the Edge of Time opens up the Seattle Science Festival this evening at the Paramount Theater. And one of the things, I watched a TED Talk that you gave on the multiverse. And one of the things, I guess, that really confuses me with my very basic science education is the notion of gravity, the explanation of gravity on Earth as opposed to gravity not on Earth, and whether it works in the same way. because the multiverse is sort of based on gravitational pull, but I thought that gravity in space was different than gravity on Earth.
Well, gravity does play a vital role in the multiverse and in our attempt to build unified theories, many things at the cutting edge of physics. And again, it really was Newton who showed us that gravity on Earth and gravity in space really are the same thing. He, in effect, instituted the first unification of the terrestrial and the beyond terrestrial, because the same force that keeps the moon in orbit around the Earth, the same force that keeps the Earth in orbit around the sun, is the force that draws our coffee cup to the ground when we drop it. And Einstein took that idea much, much further, realized that there are many subtleties in the way gravity and the cosmos can act, things that you wouldn't expect. The multiverse, in some sense, relies on the possibility that gravity can be repulsive. It isn't only an attractive force. So that's completely unfamiliar by your experience here on Earth. So in that sense, you'd say gravity in the cosmos is different, but it's simply manifesting itself differently. It's the same equations, the same law.
So instead of, say, if I'm not going to do this, but if I wanted to drop my glass of water, it falls down. Actually, the water shoots up, but that's inertia, I think, not gravity. In some places in space, instead of coming down, it might go the opposite way.
That's right. So the gravity associated with a clumpy object like the Earth or the Moon or the Sun, that is attractive. Newton got that right. But in space, space can be filled with things that aren't clumpy. Mm-hmm. Space can be filled with a kind of uniform, diffuse energy, sort of like a Turkish steam bath filling the environment with this uniform steam. There can be a uniform energy filling space. We believe, in fact, that's the case. And the gravity associated with that can be, and in fact, we believe is repulsive, pushes things apart.
So in a sense, then, maybe we should take five steps back. Instead of a universe, which is one, and this really was what I thought when I would lay in the summer out in the country and look at the, you know, where's the edge? How far does it go? What you guys theorize is that things are just spreading. There was a start, the Big Bang or whatever you want to call it, and things have been spreading ever since.
Yes. In fact, we take it one step further. When we try to understand what powered the bang, we believe it is this repulsive gravity. But if that's the case, there's no reason to anticipate that the Big Bang was a one-time event. This repulsive push could happen over and over again, yielding one bang after another at distinct places in this larger environment. Each of those bangs yields its own expanding realm, its own universe. But then there'd be many of these universes, and that's what leads us to this rather strange idea of the multiverse.
And so the fact that humans are pretty egocentric, we like to think that we're it. We're the center, somewhere. I don't know where. There could be other life forms thinking the same thing, that they're in the center.
Oh, without a doubt. We've been knocked off that pedestal so many times in the history of science. I mean, there was, of course, the natural initial thought that we were the center of it all. But then we learned that the Earth actually is more naturally thought of as going around the sun. The sun was then the center. But then we learned the sun's not really the center. It's one of many, many stars, 100 billion stars in our galaxy. Then we learned that our galaxy is not the center. There are many galaxies, probably 100 billion of those. And now the suggestion is that even the universe embracing all those galaxies is not it. It's not the center. There may be many universes.
Brian Greene, not every theoretical physicist agrees with this idea, do they?
Well, I would say that I don't agree with it either. I find it a compelling possibility, but there's no direct evidence for this idea of a multiverse yet, so it's highly speculative.
How would you get the direct evidence?
Well, it's possible that there could be imprints of other universes that we might see in ours. I like to think of it as, imagine a big cosmic bubble bath, with our universe being one expanding bubble, and there are other bubbles out there. Now, as you can imagine in your mind's eye, sometimes those bubbles might smash into each other. They can collide. Mm-hmm. And if our universe got hit by another, calculations, again, in the math, suggest that there should be an observational signature of that in what we call the cosmic microwave background radiation. A lot of words.
Wow.
But it's just heat that's left over from the Big Bang. It's around us right now. It's in this room right now, in fact. If you had the right equipment, I would measure it for you.
Okay.
And there are certain temperature variations in this heat that would fall into a very particular pattern if our universe got hit by another. So people have very powerful telescopes examining the heavens, looking for that, among other things. As yet, there isn't any evidence suggesting that it's there, but we're just at the start of this journey.
What kind of information, for example, is the Hubble telescope providing to this search?
Well, the Hubble telescope is a vital piece of evidence for a lot of the theories that we are basing these ideas upon. The Hubble telescope has given us our sharpest, deepest understanding of the cosmos to date, together with other satellite-borne telescopes, a very powerful one that was known as WMAP, and one that is up there right now, the Planck satellite. These are our devices for looking back right near the beginning of our universe. We're looking back tens of billions of years, around 13 billion years we're looking back. And it's that data that drives these theoretical speculations.
So when you sit around with your students, do you sit around with computers and make calculations? I mean, this isn't something like you're bringing in chunks of meteors and looking at them for evidence of something else. I mean, you are postulating things.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, anytime any news organization wants to do a story, they say, can we come to your lab? I was like, you can come. There's not much to see because it's just a bunch of blackboards, some students and some computers. I mean, my students right now, for instance, are involved in a calculation of what happens when universes collide. And some of it can be done on paper with pencil, mm-hmm. but a lot of it requires computers to do the calculations. And that's why it is wholly theoretical. We don't have as yet the ability to do anything in the laboratory, if you will, that can give us the kind of insight that one would like.
Well, journalists like me would come to you when announcements of, for example, the Higgs boson particle come out and you guys are all really excited and we read that and we're like, what is this particle? So I still, you're here, so I'm going to ask you, what is this particle?
Oh, the Higgs particle? Well, it's tangentially related to the story, but there are some connections. So back in the 60s or so, an interesting puzzle was, where does the heft, where does the mass of individual particles come from? And mass I like to think of as the resistance an object offers when you try to change its speed, right?
Sure.
You try to change the speed of a big rock, you have to push hard on it. That's evidence that the rock has mass.
Mm-hmm.
Question is, when it comes to individual particles, where does that mass come from? And an idea that goes back to many physicists, including Peter Higgs, whose name is most closely associated with it, is that the mass comes from the following strange idea. That space is filled, again, with a uniform substance. It's kind of a molasses-like substance. We now call it the Higgs field.
Mm-hmm.
And when a particle tries to speed up through the Higgs field, it kind of feels a resistance, like a little pebble dropping through molasses would feel resistance. And that's where the mass comes from. Now, if this idea was right, how would you test it? Well, if space really is filled with this Higgs field, then if you jiggle space enough, you might be able to fleck off a little speck of this molasses mm-hmm. that we would call the Higgs particle, the Higgs boson.
Right.
So this machine in Geneva, what does it do? It smashes protons together near the speed of light, trying to jiggle the Higgs field, sort of like submarines colliding, jiggle the water around them. And last July, the announcement came that a little fleck of this Higgs stuff had been knocked off and detected. The Higgs boson was found.
And so I'm going back. This is how non-theoretical physicist brain I have to that idea, to Newton and that idea of gravity, because we're still, even though it's molasses and flicking things off, it's still, we're still talking about that same thing, a force moving, right?
Yes, the mass that we are talking about is the very same mass that would dictate how these particles would fall, a la your coffee cup, a la
right.
Newton. Why it is the case that the mass I'm talking about with this resistance from the molasses is the same mass that Newton was talking about when an object's fall is a very, very deep question that we believe Einstein answered for us with something called the equivalence principle.
Mm-hmm.
He showed that there is an equivalence between these two ideas that seem so separate. We now believe that they are the same.
We're talking with Brian Green, and as you can tell, this is like lesson number one of physics for me. You told me before the show started that you have two young kids. You wrote Icarus at the Edge of Time for kids. So when you sit down with your two young kids in New York City, where do you start to sort of lay the groundwork for explaining what it is that you do and why it's important.
Well, I try not to push it on them because I'd like them to do whatever they really want to do, what they're passionate about. But when I wrote the book, Icarus at the Edge of Time, and it came from the publisher, I wanted my son to read it. He was five at the time, but I didn't want to push it on him as if, oh, Dad, keep your stuff away. You know? So I wanted him to find it on his own. So I left copies around the house, many, many copies around the house. And he found and had my wife read it to him. And by the end of the story, he was crying because, to make the short story even shorter, at the end of the story, his father's dead. Long since dead, and people who go tonight to the performance will understand why. So people have asked me, didn't it make you feel bad that you wrote a story that made your young son cry? And at some sense, the answer is yes. But my bigger answer, which I love to say, is if general relativity can make a five-year-old cry, I think that's a good thing, because it means that science is not some abstract idea to a young child. It's a set of ideas that can really matter to life. And when you see science that way, not as a subject, but something mm-hmm. that really matters to your engagement with reality, science comes alive. And every kid needs to have that experience.
I think often, though, science is a requirement that you have to take. And it's not explained, or at least it wasn't when I was in school, as a creative, like painting a painting or writing, or like what Philip Glass does. It wasn't in that same category of creativity.
Yeah, that's tragic. It's tragic that science is portrayed that way. And look, there are many really good science teachers and science classes around the country. I've visited some spectacular sure. ones. But by and large, science is, as you're saying, not presented as a creative, living, breathing entity. Rather, it is presented as this body of facts that are between the pages of a textbook. And that's not what science is.
Well, it's interesting because right now, at least in Washington State, I don't know about the rest of the country, there is that effort for the STEM educational program, science, technology, engineering, and math, I think is what it stands for. And there's a lot of people that want to put art in there because they see that correlation between development of creative thinking and what you need to sit around with the blackboard and your students. What you're doing is thinking up ideas.
That's right. So there is a deep connection between arts and science, and STEM is being shifted in some people's minds to STEAM. The one thing that I would say, and perhaps this is an unpopular thing to say, I've seen some really bad art-science connections. It can bring out the worst in both fields very, very quickly. But I think as the field begins to mature and people find organic links between art and science, not ones that feel forced, then really you can't begin to revolutionize the way these subjects are put forward.
We talked about multiverse. What do you imagine, where do you imagine scientific research will be in a decade?
That's a good question and a hard one. You know, we have this machine that we mentioned, the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, that has now found this Higgs particle.
Right.
It's not found anything else. It's not found anything surprising. It's not found anything that's made us go back to the drawing board. And if it doesn't find anything else, any evidence of string theory, for instance, what I work on, or other more exotic theories, supersymmetry, words of that sort, I'm not sure what's going to happen. It could be that this kind of science begins to migrate more towards mathematics departments. It becomes viewed as a body of theoretical calculations that isn't directly relevant to the world, at least not yet. That could happen. If people have sufficient foresight to recognize that the way science works is even a null result, even not finding something, is a big result and should propel the next machine to be built, then things will be healthy. But I'm not sure what will happen.
I thought that was the whole point of science, that you try, fail, try, succeed.
I agree with you. But let me ask you the following question. You're called in front of Congress to make an argument for spending $10 or $20 billion on the next machine. And you say, look, we didn't find anything unexpected at the previous machine, so now we need something even bigger and more powerful. That should be a good argument, but it can be a hard sell compared to saying, hey, we've got glimmers at the Large Hadron Collider, something weird at the next energy level. We've got to build that next machine. We want it on American soil, so we are leading the frontier, pushing the cutting edge. I think that would fall on more receptive ears if that were the argument that we could make.
Do you think American science is at the cutting edge?
It is at the cutting edge in many ways, but there's a huge lost potential. I mean, we were building the superconducting supercollider in Texas. That would have been much more powerful than the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva. And after spending something like $1 billion, the project was canceled. And that's, again, one of those tragic moments in American science.
How is the sequester affecting what you do?
Well, everybody's worried. Everybody is looking at the bottom line of budgets across the board. I mean, we're supported at Columbia by the Department of Energy. National Science Foundation supports many other physics departments. And we are bracing for those cuts, which really make a difference. We are not expensive, us theorists. All we need is some computers, support for students, postdocs, you know, summer support. So our numbers are relatively small. But when things are cut by a percent, everybody feels it. Everybody gets hurt.
And at the end, it's a big hurt because it all adds up.
Yes, for sure.
Sort of like the little Higgs particle in the quagmire of molasses over there in Switzerland. Brian Green is a theoretical physicist at Columbia University. He co-directs Columbia's Institute for Strings, Cosmology, and Astroparticle Physics, which is a beautiful title in and of itself. And tonight, the Seattle Science Foundation, Seattle Science Festival, will kick off at the Paramount Theater with a performance of Icarus at the Edge of Time, which is a composition by Philip Glass based on a book by you, and not just for those who went through their STEM program, you assure the listeners.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for trying to explain physics to me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is 94.9 KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman. And now, the sound of the day. Okay, Bernard, this is Animal Week. That's the sound of Christine riding a horse up a hill. I think she's on the horse. Because I think I hear the squeal of the saddle.
Yeah, there's a lot of unusual sounds going on there.
We're interested in the sounds around you, what you're listening to. We'd love you to record 30 seconds of the sound. Send it to us along with the story behind the sound. You can email your file to weekday@kuow.org. And please include sound of the day in the subject line. Coming up in the next hour of the show, we're going to talk about patent trolls and the Obama administration's efforts to regulate them. Also, meeting some of our favorite dinosaurs. Steve Scherer comes in with
things are going to get a little bit science-y next hour as well.
Yeah, we're all about science here on KUOW, so stay with us.
It's 9:59. In the news today, Verizon has reportedly been turning over its customers' phone records to the government. An update on what we're learning about that in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Laird Norton Wealth Management, celebrating 75 years of King County Parks by establishing the King County Parks Foundation, devoted to strengthening families and connecting communities for generations to come. Information on contributing at ourparksourfuture.org.
Do you know what you did yesterday?
No, I don't.
How about this morning?
I don't even remember that.
Henry Mollison's amnesia, caused by experimental brain surgery for epilepsy in 1953, helped neuroscientists understand how memory works. On the next Fresh Air, we meet Suzanne Corkin, who studied him for decades. Join us.
You can hear that tonight at 8 on KUOW's second program service, KUOW 2. It's on HD radio and it's online at KUOW2.org. Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.